as we solemnly march down our checklist of things that have to occur before the Civil War, we get to the bloodiest checkmark before the Civil War, Bleeding Kansas. Organized violence, American on American violence. And I want to be clear on this, organized American on American violence over the issue of slavery. So while you'll see slave rebellions, you'll see occasional uprisings that are led by abolitionists, Kansas, Nebraska, and specifically, well, Bloody Kansas, is the first time you see militias essentially fighting each other.
Welcome back to the Buck Starts Here, podcast that digs deep in the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I am Kyle, the Jake Paul to Eric's Joshua, and today we're finishing up with the penultimate president of the single-term dead zone by examining Franklin Pierce's presidency. And we are recording this before finding out if it's physically possible for another human to punch another human's head clean off their shoulders. So if this intro is still there, then the answer to that remains unconfirmed. How you doing, Eric? Are you
gonna watch that intro? I'm so scared.
Are you going to watch the Jake Paul fight this weekend?
No. I was watching John Cena's retirement match.
Oh.
The real cultural event of all time.
Dude.
So are you ready talking about violent motions? Are you ready to talk about piercing?
Yeah, is Pierce going to get violent?
No, I was just like, I'm trying to go. Pierce is a violent motion. As we left off, Pierce is newly elected, and he gets inaugurated in on March 4th, 1853. And he inherits a very divided nation, and he comes in.
He's putting it mildly.
Yeah, it's real mildly. So the horrific nature of Millard Fillmore's term finally comes to an end.
Yeah, and a divided nation, but also right after the most ineffective president we've had to date.
Kyle, that's the word, man. That is right? Really the word. Ineffective. At a time where America needed strong leadership, they were faced with, as Truman called, a hand-raggler. So he comes in. His tone when he gets inaugurated is it's a phrase that gets used a lot, but sometimes gets lost in all the different phrases and terminology of the antebellum period, is sectional conciliation. And the idea of sectional conciliation is the idea of, like, let's really push for a renewed peace by accepting a constitutional interpretation of the things we disagree with. In other words, like, let's just let the Constitution decide it. But with the Compromise of 1850, as Kyle and I discussed a few episodes ago, that's lost. That's lost with the Fugitive Slave Act and with what the Dred Scott decision and the growth of popular sovereignty as how to decide if you can have free states or slave states. We, you know, for lack of a better term, we've moved beyond reconciliation. There is no, the battle lines have quite literally been drawn.
Can I just say, too, like, that's such a misnomer to call that the Compromise of 1850s. Like, that just makes it sound like it's something better than it is.
It's not. No. It's like not actually a compromise. It's appeasement.
Yes.
So he starts in 1853, and this is where Franklin Pierce really starts falling apart as his ability to be a president. So right off the bat, he forms a cabinet. And it was cabinet. I will say Jefferson Davis was the Secretary of War.
Really?
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting. Kind of foreshadowing a little bit,
right?
But he basically drew from a pool in his cabinet of a bunch of Northern and Southern Democrats, and tried to put them together in a cabinet. It was not an effective cabinet whatsoever. It just didn't work because he was looking. He's a party builder. He's a platform builder.
He wasn't picking it based off of qualifications. He was picking it based off of party position.
It was mostly party positions. I will say,
is it just trying to keep a balance then? Try to keep, like, Northerners and Southerners basically happy with?
Yeah, that, like, I can't yell at the presidency because one of my guys is part of it, is part of the cabinet. I will say Caleb Cushing was his attorney general. I believe Caleb Cushing is considered a...
heard that name a few times.
Yeah, he was a very good attorney general. Yes. He's across multiple presidents. William Macy was the Secretary of State. Again, I believe William Macy is considered a very competent Secretary of State and did negotiate several international contracts or treaties. I don't mm-hmm. want to say treaties. Treaties have to be ratified by – I hate when we keep hearing the word treaty. And I'm like, treaty is a big deal. It has to be ratified by Congress.
So like, what is the right term then?
Agreement, I guess. It's not that enforceable. Yeah, what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah.
But his focus is primarily domestic, even though he will settle some border issues. But he starts practicing patronage politics. And so he has this concept called rotation in office, which is he rotates people through different appointments who help the party, or helps the Democratic Party or helped him. But instead of making people happy because they're in and out, they're getting these political appointments, it actually produces like a ton. It produces a ton of intra-party friction. We really do see waves and waves of people. If you try to make everybody happy, you make no one happy.
Right.
So he's in office and he's trying to keep the Democratic Party, his Democratic allies, happy. Because again, this isn't something where they're pressuring him to do it. This is how he's built consensus his entire career. But now he's an executive. He's not legislating. He's the final decision maker.
This is kind of like the same thing that happened with Fillmore, where like the reason why you picked him is just the exact reason that makes him not an effective leader.
Exactly. So as he begins his presidency, he's really focused on infrastructure. Like his whole thing is he wants to do administrative reforms in infrastructure. He sounds like Martin
Van Buren early on. That sounds good. Yeah.
Interesting enough is that the Democratic Party is very supportive of infrastructure administrative reforms at the time. But almost immediately, he gets pushed into the discussion of slavery's expansion. And what really spurs that is one of William Macy's success, which is the Gadsden Purchase, which happened in December 1853, so towards the end of his presidency.
That's my state.
I was going to say Kyle's favorite purchase ever done. So it's
$15 million, same amount as the Louisiana Purchase.
Better land, though. It's Arizona.
Right.
So he acquires this land. He acquires this land from Mexico, which is present-day southern Arizona, New Mexico.
Yuma.
Yes. Oh, and Kyle, what was his argument for paying so much for the Gadsden Purchase?
Was it for Yuma?
It was for the Transcontinental Railroad.
Oh, I didn't know that went through there.
Yeah, so they're building a southern transcontinental railroad route, and
So the one thing that I remember standing out to me was that they're supposed to get a port in the Baja coastline there. When the guy was doing the surveying, they bribed him. Mexico bribed him to make a little turn. That's why it's got that little angle up.
Yeah, because we would have taken the entire country.
Definitely would have taken the entire Baja.
I still think the funniest part is during the Mexican-American War, the Navy ships showing up on the west coast of Mexico. I was like, guys, here's how far you had to travel to get here. No, we're good, right? We're good. We're good, right? It's like, what are you here for? What war is being fought over? I'm like, that's a flex.
How did you make it through that strait in South America? That place is gnarly.
You basically travel 10,000 miles to jump scare the Mexicans. Like, that's just funny to me. Like, with the Mexican military that had no effective navy, like,
right?
Because you've already destroyed it. And why would they have a navy on their west coast? It's like, there's nothing even here. Like, what are you doing? How we did not end up with Baja California after that is beyond me. So the Gadsden Purchase is primarily to build the southern route of the Transcontinental Railroad. One of my favorite old Western movies, even though not old Western movies, one of my favorite Western movies, 3:10 to Yuma.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Russell Crowe, right?
Yep. And you could thank Franklin Pierce for that movie.
Okay. Thank
which is the
you,
only positive
Pierce.
Thing I will be able to associate with Franklin Pierce is a good movie. He's not a pushover like Fillmore, but he's not doing it in a way he's like trying to start war. He's just like, hey, let's settle this border dispute. Mm-hmm. And it had commercial ambitions to it. To be honest with you, there was also a little bit of it where Mexico felt like they were saving face too.
Yeah, like, right.
A little bit like
they
we got
pretty
paid
good price for that. Yeah.
And he opens up trade with Japan, so he follows up on Millard Fillmore's opening of Japan, but specifically he signs the first treaty with Japan that actually opens it up to commercial interests. Opens a limited amount of Japanese ports and creates a new Pacific commercial foothold that would really persist up until about World War II.
I think this is too about the period where if you like Dan Carlin's hardcore history, He does a really interesting deep dive into like the way the Japanese like remade their entire like self-image from like the 1850s on.
Yeah, it's like they're like, we need some of those pieces of metal tubes that go boom.
Right.
He ends his first year of his presidency on a big up note. There's a lot of positive, feelings. The United States isn't feeling good at this point. It's a sick man, and it knows something bad's going to happen. I really do believe that like people were sensing this, but suddenly you have this
Would you
president,
kind of describe it as like the moment of clarity right before the event happens?
right? Like, so they have this warming period in 1853 where they elect this northerner who never owned a slave. But he's supported by the Democratic Party, and he's able to build this coalition government of Northern Dems and Southern Dems. He settles border disputes without going to war, makes America look strong. It's not the, very timid nature of Miller Fillmore. 1854 starts off nice. You have the, opening of Japan. America is seen as not a colonializer, but a commercial trader. Even though we did it in a very, you open your doors or we will
Or we'll
have
open them.
America West.
We've got all these ships that go the wrong side of the continent because of Mexico. We
Yeah.
don't know what to do with them.
Yeah. By the way, this is the Navy after 1840 is the funniest organization. They're just like showing up everywhere. They're like, want to fight? It's like, no, why are you here? You don't even have any. Like, we have eight
Ships.
Marines with us. It's like, yeah, but you have no ability to disembark. We have eight Marines. We'll be fine. It's like, why? This all falls apart in May of 1854, and we see a complete collapse of Pierce's ability to effectively continue his process of appeasement to both sides.
What happened? Something in
He
particular
signed
came?
the Kansas-Nebraska Act, also known as Bloody Kansas. And
I remember Kansas.
as we solemnly march down our checklist of things that have to occur before the Civil War, we get to the bloodiest check mark before the Civil War, Bleeding Kansas. This is the first time we will see organized violence, American-on-American violence. And I want to be clear on this, organized American-on-American violence over the issue of slavery. So while you'll see slave rebellions, you'll see occasional, uprisings that are led by abolitionists, Kansas, Nebraska, and specifically, well, Bloody Kansas, it's the first time you see militias essentially fighting each other. It's where John Brown will make his name. John Brown, famous of Harper
Harper's
Ferry
Ferry
fame.
Johnson, man.
Yep, we'll make it. And what the Kansas-Nebraska Act did is it reorganized the territories of Kansas-Nebraska, so made them what they effectively are today, like their borders, but then induced popular sovereignty, which, like, as we talked about earlier, is the idea of people getting to vote
Well,
in order.
that just led to people organizing groups to come up and vote the way they wanted it to
Yep.
be voted, right?
And those two groups fighting each other. And what this did was this underlined something we talked about last episode, something we mildly mentioned last episode, which is the Missouri Compromise. So the Missouri Compromise had existed as a status quo since 1820, which created a boundary between slave states where slavery would be legal and where slavery wouldn't be legal in the United States. And you got to remember, we have the Fugitive Slave Act that had been signed as part of the Compromise in 1850. Pierce is aggressively enforcing that. But now that there are states that can now vote to be slave states, and they're flooding those areas with people who would vote for that, and then abolitionists are flooding that area with abolitionists, and they're having violent clashes, and it starts to become part of the national ethos of this violent reaction to the expansion of slavery. And
Sorry, so did that we don't think that Pierce necessarily believed in this platform, but because this was the package that was passed and this is what was supposed to be holding the Union together, we think that his
He viewed it as his constitutional duty. He kept the same line as Miller Fillmore. And he viewed slavery as being part of the Constitution, and there's no way to alter it.
How do you see Millard Fillmore go down this path of complete ineffectualism and think, yes, that's the way to do it?
Yeah, I think he thought he would be able to meter it better. And he simply wasn't. In fact, his signing of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, was the first time it became, the actions that would lead to the Civil War became acceptable, the act of violence. And right. if Miller Fillmore killed emancipationism, Franklin Pierce killed reconciliation. Because it became, if we, any weakening of your position strengthened the other side, which could then vote, make more slave states, they could bring slaves wherever they wanted to, because the Dred Scott decision and the Fugitive Slave Act made, basically the Dred Scott decision said, hey, you can bring slaves wherever you want, and if that, if you bring those slaves to a free state and the slave runs away, Fugitive Slave Act is, federal government has to hunt down that slave. I often think, what would Zachary Taylor have thought of that? That you brought that up a couple episodes, Kyle, and that's been burning me.
Right? Yeah.
You would have been like, what's not my job? How about I just, he's like, how about I just take your land? It's like, oh, shit, okay. he's on the offense.
Right.
Zachary Taylor, he practiced self-offense, not self-defense. So basically the effect of removing the Missouri line, the Missouri Compromise that functioned as the do not pass area for slave expansion collapsed. It basically, that concept of the Missouri Compromise falling apart collapsed the national alignments in the United States.
Hadn't it already been collapsed because of California coming in as a free state?
So, think of the Missouri Compromise where slavery stops expanding, not necessarily where freedom, I guess it says freedom stops expanding. Yeah. Okay. So this shattered these very fragile political alignments that existed both within states and within the within Congress. And it turned, and Kyle, you hit the foreshadowing right on the nose, buddy. It energized the anti-slavery politics in the North. And this has really created the Republican Party as we know it today, was that energization after the Kansas-Nebraska Act. So the aftermath of him signing Kansas-Nebraska, he saw this coming, but it destroyed his northern base.
It's not surprising, but yeah.
I think he thought the Democratic Party's platform would be able to survive something like this, and he just bet wrong on that. So he's standing within the North, both in the Democratic Party and generally among the populace, just completely evaporated.
How do you even recognize the decisions that were made on Bloody Kansas? Like, how do you even, uphold whatever happened there, right? Like, that's what blows my mind. Like, how do you not redo that?
How do you not reverse it? How do you not see it?
Right.
This horrific thing happened. I go, oh, I guess it's fine.
You know what? We should probably go sort this out.
Yeah, right. Like, maybe we shouldn't have essentially many civil wars breaking off in places that aren't states yet. They're still territories. Like, you right. can still legislate them. They don't have their own constitution. They literally don't have their own constitution because they're literally a federal territory. You control it, Mr. Pierce. That's right. Your land. It's like D.C.
Right.
And so, the Southerners view him as very favorable. The give and take isn't there. The Southerners always viewed him as favorable. They weren't going to elect Winfield Scott. That's an insane position to them. They probably liked, I'm now realizing that they definitely liked Millard Fillmore more than Winfield Scott. That's before Winfield right. Scott engaged in a dance with them. So wouldn't Bleeding Kansas, as it becomes known, is really best described academically as the federal alignment with pro-slavery territorial authority. And by the federal government essentially permitting the migration and self-appointing elections. So like this territory was like kind of doing its own elections to decide if it's going to be free or not. They were horribly contested. I mean, they were basically doing everything they could to vote suppress to get slavery supported.
For bringing in your own votes.
Yeah, it was just right. Like even defining how to vote, who was allowed to vote was a very weird process. Right. But their posture of how they did it, they treated the official government territory produced by the reorganization of the electoral process as legitimate. So basically they had all these like shammy elections and the Pierce administration like agreed with them.
Sure, that's good. We'll certify those results.
Yeah, and then they went in there and they removed or moved different officials that they thought were obstructing that vote. like after the vote went through, you'd have officials being like, hey, just let you know, like that vote never really occurred. Or like they would be like, oh, hey, just let you know, like they only let like four people vote in this election. Would just remove them.
Really?
And they were doing it over and over and over and over again and always siding with the pro-slavery side.
Mm-hmm. Was he just afraid of that side? Like, I guess that was his, I mean, that was his party, right? So.
Yeah. I mean, it was bizarre because the Democratic Party was not homogenous on the slavery vote at this time. There was Northern Democrats. But what really turned to, and I think this is something that gets kind of forgotten as we come to the falling action of the end of 1856. So we're almost done with this presidency, which is crazy to think of it.
Wild, yeah.
Right. So as
I hear a low score coming up.
Oh, yeah. What really tells the story of Pierce is or Pierce's behavior with slavery and Pierce's behavior in Kansas, in bloody Kansas and Kansas, Nebraska, is what he did in Kansas. So in 1856, this is wild to me. I mean, this is something that I think if Pierce was more memorable, mm-hmm. we would know more. This would be something more common. But the administration really went after these extra legal rival institutions that existed in these different states. So particularly there was these free state structures that were formed outside the federally recognized territorial framework. And basically these were areas of Kansas that were like, hey, that election was a sham. We don't recognize it. And everybody's saying it's a sham. So we're going to form like our own group that's going to vote and try and have like an actual vote to protect property sovereignty. Pierce called them insurrectionists and sent the military to put down the insurrection.
Did the military listen?
It did not really come. It did. I mean, there were clashes, but it wasn't
didn't come
like,
that far.
Yeah, it wasn't like horrific. I mean, it's horrific, but it wasn't.
It takes a month to probably get the army sent down to put down whatever insurrection anyway, right? So you probably got some time to be like, oh, never mind. We're good. We'll stop.
But this dissolved Pierce's really ability to govern. It reinforced the view of the North that, you know, his presidency was basically using the federal government to create favorable outcomes for slavery expansion, even when, like, people in the territory, even like, see, we always talk about the slave owners who moved in, and we always talk about the abolitionists who moved in, but there were just settlers there. And even those settlers were like, I wasn't even allowed to vote, and I've been in this territory for 10, 20 years. It would dissolve it because even in the South, they viewed him as so favorable that it destroyed his ability to practice conciliation. He was just seen as a Northerner who fell in line with the Southern slave-owning group. Now, was he doing that because he was pro-slavery?
So that's the question I've been asking this whole time.
Most of the stuff I've read is no. It's he believed slavery was part of the Constitution, and he viewed himself as a strict constitutionist who believed in limited government intervention outside the Constitution.
I still don't get where you can. We studied the Constitution on this program, and I don't see anything in there that justifies slavery.
Yeah,
anything in there, it puts an end date on it.
Yeah, right. And so he ends up using this as kind of, and the North sees it as a weak argument. The South's gotten everything it's wanted.
Yeah, that is a weak argument. There's an end date on there. Why is he not strict on that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, at this time, the USS Constellation is out there stopping slave trade. That was a little bit before, but we are stopping the slave trade, which is what's outlawed in 1808.
Domestic slave trade.
It's not the domestic slave trade. Right. I really feel like that would be funny. To, like,
that's a big loophole.
Yeah, it's a huge loophole.
Right.
Like the biggest loophole possible.
It's yes.
And this creates massive polarization. And there's a bridge or a tunnel, Sumner Tunnel in Massachusetts. And
what's
it's named after. Sorry?
What was the name?
Sumner. S-U-M-N-E-R. It's named after Sumner. Senator Charles Sumner.
Okay.
Sumner. I'm saying with
not
my boss's accent.
Sure.
Yeah. And there's a bridge named after him. And the reason there was is because he was beaten almost to death by a crew of pro-slavery Southern senators for speaking out against slavery. He was caned in the Senate and almost died. The beating of Senator Charles Sumner becomes such a beautiful example of where we are, should say, discussing an example of where the politics are on here. And make no mistake, Pierce is not an innocent bystander here. He's causing this, and he's causing it by his enforcement of the Fugitive Act, his signing of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. So at this point, his support nationwide has evaporated. Even the Democratic Party doesn't want him anymore.
Wow.
And what's interesting is that there are Secretary of State Macy is having, honestly, some interesting, I think actually very interesting adventures as this is going on.
Right.
Because in 1854, there's something called the Onstead Manifesto, which is a hellacious name. But right. Austin Manifesto was an argument that the United States should consider acquiring Cuba by purchase, if possible, or by stronger measures if Spain refused. And this got leaked. And basically the North was like, what are you going to do? Get Cuba and put more slaves on? I'm not joking. That was literally what the North said. They're like, you're just trying to get Cuba to get more slaves, have a plantation economy down there. And the administration never actually addressed this. They were just they kind of tried to soft talk their way out of it. And people were, this was 1854. People were like, don't trust anything that they're saying. But this also hurts the South because this wasn't a policy of the Democratic Party. They're like, oh my God, the North has in terms of population, obviously a 3/5 compromise helps the South a lot in terms of electorate. But they're like, guys, we're going to this is going to be an actual problem if you guys keep doing this. So the South doesn't even like it. In that same year, you start to see he supported the Reciprocity Treaty of 1854, where
what was that one?
It basically allowed an expansion of trade of natural products, so wood, beaver pelts, things like that, between British North American colonies, which is primarily Canada, and the United States. On First Nation status, so basically everybody would trade with the best with the best prices.
This is actually first NAFTA.
Dude, honestly, the first NAFTA. I like that one, dude. That's awesome. But this ends up being broadly successful, and actually seen as one of the first international trade agreements between the U.S. and Canada. But again, he has no ability to celebrate these wins because they're just. Always this shadow. His entire presidency is overshadowed by Kansas, Nebraska. And he would lose. Let me phrase that. So not only did he lose the nomination of the Democratic Party,
he lost the nomination?
Yeah, he actually went to the convention and sought renomination. But this man, who just 4 years earlier was seen as his compromised candidate, who had broad support, completely lacked any support. Nor the Democrats viewed him as honestly horrifically hurtful to their viewpoints. And the Southern Democrats were empowered. They got everything they wanted from this. They kind of got everything they wanted from Millard Fillmore, too. And so who do they elect? They elect the worst president ever. They elect James Buchanan. In any party that thinks that James Buchanan, or any electorate at the time who thinks that James Buchanan is a reconciler candidate, is completely wrong.
No.
So in 1856, he becomes only the second president to lose his nomination from his party.
Dude, that's insane. You know how bad you have to be to not even get your nomination?
Right? In the party that, is made up of people you did everything...
Who was the first one who didn't get it?
Millard Fillmore.
Fillmore? Okay.
That was back-to-back, dude. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Oof. So Pierce ends up leaving office on March 4th, 1857, when James Buchanan is sworn in the big spoiler. he returned to New Hampshire, and he actually led a pretty successful private legal practice. He went back to civic life, but his public reputation... was bad. It was very hard. He lived to see the problems he created, and especially in New Hampshire, which his motto is literally "Live free or die."
Right.
You can possibly imagine what their opinions were about him.
Did he ever recover from that? Did he ever?
No, he campaigned a lot on national unity, and he always pushed constitutional restraint and compromise. But this perpetual reliance on compromise as some sort of like vindication for having supported slavery, just nobody believed it. The right. South didn't care, and the North was like, this is horrible. Look what you did. Right. So in 1859, he actually kind of withdraws from public life and goes to Europe. He spends basically 2 years in Europe visiting different, different kings and regents.
Is he doing the Martin Van Buren tour? Or just be like,
dude, like kind of,
these guys are weird.
dude, kind of, like honestly. I mean, this is something that a lot of presidents did afterwards. But he was still very attentive to U.S. politics. He would have newspapers like sent over to him. He would have these correspondents. But he was not an active institutional leader at any level. This is right where like the undersea cables or telegrams are starting to get built, which is, I just think is kind of cool.
That's so wild that this is that long ago.
Dude, right? Is that kind of weird? Like you were saying, like Morse code. And by the time he returns to the United States in 1859, he wants to rejoin the Democratic Party. And what he finds is a completely splintered party. That is,
they're at the wrong time.
Right. There's just huge gaps in, sectional lines. And Pierce was excited for this because he was like, good, I can show the Democratic Party what my skill set is. So
he thought he could come and clean up the mess.
So he comes in there and he starts talking about defending party traditional, like, the party's traditional constitutional leanings, leaning heavy on Jefferson and the Constitution, and how we need to frame slavery as being, part of the Constitution, even if it's something that people don't like. But something starts to happen where as he's talking about this, nobody's listening. Mm-hmm. And he starts vocalizing that he, on both sides, he's like, he actually has this moment where he's like, wait. What are you guys doing? Look at all these extra legal actions that both the pro-slavery and anti-slavery crowds are doing. What's going on?
Loading the rifles.
Dude, right? And he's like, he couldn't understand why nobody was coming to the table to talk. But he saw himself increasingly aligned with Democratic voices that argued that the Union could be preserved only through renewed compromise and a strict adherence to constitutional limits. So he's still searching for that compromise. So in 1860, obviously the most important election in U.S. history, Pierce opposed all these new political coalitions that were consolidating in the North and regarded the election as a dangerous inflection point. So even before the election, he's like, this is really, really bad. And Pierce is being public, he's being open about this, but he keeps advocating over and over again. His writings to newspapers, his public speeches, is he has an opposition to disunity, but also an opposition to coercive solutions. And so people are sitting there, they're going, well, so what do you believe? You think you're against the Union dissolving, but you're also against anything to keep the Union together. So as late 1860 comes around, so right near where Lincoln gets elected, Pierce, he starts campaigning, not as a president, but as somebody with ideas that would help, that he thinks would save the Union. So he starts talking openly. This is actually becomes very interesting. He starts talking, instead of trying to constantly stitch the wounds back together, he now takes a different approach of talking about why they're there. And this is that compromise tradition that has made up almost all of Franklin Pierce's life. So he viewed the failures not as necessarily a disagreement, but as a culmination of other failures, political extremism, moral absolutism, and institutional weakness. rather than what it really was. The country had reached the breaking point on the slavery issue. He still thought that it was other things causing it. He viewed slavery as a part of the Constitution and therefore something that was intrinsic to the system itself.
God, that's such a weird take.
It is, and it's kind of a blind take too. It's a lazy take. It is. It's like, sometimes a tree is just a tree, man. Sometimes that's all it is. But this position left him very broken when he was encountered with the realities of 1861. So once secession became operational, non-conflict began, he was kind of like a shell of himself.
Good. Look what you did.
Well, yeah. And he realized that compromise didn't work. You know, he ends up, and then he ends up taking these, almost can be described as bizarre positions on the war. So,
what?
Yeah. Like, this is, I think, the most interesting part of Pierce's, not even, I don't know, I was going to say post-presidency, but almost his entire life. So he doesn't become, you know, he's not involved in the administration of the war. He's not a military figure. But he ends up having these continuously rhetorical, he uses his reputation to continue to like push this, like these rhetorical dialogues. That's what they usually call rhetorical dialogues. I don't know what they're actually called at the time.
Is that just where like, you have like a thought experiment where you argue with yourself?
And kind of, but imagine doing that publicly.
Pose questions, yeah.
Yeah, and so he starts talking about we need to preserve the Republican government because it's the only way that you can protect and propagate civil liberties in a constitutional process. But he says we have to limit the executive power even during a national emergency, which he considered the war national emergency. This is where it gets wild. He basically said the Union had to restrain itself when it came to protecting itself from the South.
Don't suspend habeas corpus kind of?
Yeah, like, don't march like an army. Kind of stuff? Yeah, kind of like don't even march an army down there.
Oh, what? Well, that's a wild take.
And again,
let them
we are we are kind of like generalizing this, but he said as he realized what the Union was doing, that it was going to win this war. Like, this was going to be and the Civil War was an incredibly definitive war. I think people don't realize, like, because we talk about, states' rights, no, that's not true. it was a definitive war. The Confederacy no longer existed. Everything the Confederacy stood for no longer existed. All the policies. At the end of the war, there was no Fugitive Slave Act. At the end of the war,
no longer existed.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
right.
It was just, I'm going to say it, we won. I'm going to be jerk northerner. Like, it was an absolute, actually anybody who's pro-America,
America,
it's we. Yeah.
It won.
And
that includes the South.
But during the war, so he starts gathering these people, they're called Copperheads, which are anti-administration Democrats. And he starts calling for peace the entire war. And he didn't believe the federal government had the right for federal war powers, federal wartime powers. He didn't believe in that. He believed that the Lincoln basically having an army fighting the South was an executive overreach. And he also,
it's like a decent argument.
He also hated the idea that, the war was about emancipation and the destruction of slavery became central to Union objectives of the war. That he was like, if you are going to fight a war, it should just be for secession, but you shouldn't be allowed to fight a war for secession. And now you want to emancipate slaves. But he had these two ideas where he was
such a weird take.
He was against secession,
right?
But he was against any way to preserve the Union. And this led to an impossible stance.
Yeah.
And,
how do you resolve a war if the thing you're fighting over, you're not allowed to be able to change?
Yeah. And where Pierce would destroy his legacy, is that as
anything left.
Yeah. Right. But where this would bury him historically. And he would, again, he would see this in his life. As the Union war death mounted, Pierce became increasingly vocal in his beliefs of, restraint and this Southern reconciliation and all these fantasy beliefs. Soon the public, even of his hometown, turned on him. They viewed him as unpatriotic. They viewed him as indulgent towards, Southern demands.
Mm-hmm.
And some even said he was openly hostile towards the Union. Even today, there are some, civil liberty, I don't want to say, groups, but, professors and people who admire Pierce for saying what he said about, you know, government suspending, you know, habeas corpus and all that stuff. But all those people, when you actually go read what they write, they're like, we're happy you said that. But also, this guy was a lunatic.
He said a lot of other crazy things.
Yeah, it's all like, guys, let's not snip people.
Right.
This would follow his life, because he would actually live to see the end of the war. And as you saw Reconstruction take life, I think there was a little bit of Pierce who I think he was done. Because he never embraced – there's nothing that shows he ever embraced the idea of Reconstruction. And Pierce had become this forgotten man who, when he's reminded of his positions, is usually mocked harshly. His legacy turns into really falls apart as a man who is – it's one thing to be unable to manage and to be forced with, like, you inherit the Comrades of 1850. That stinks. You signed Kansas, Nebraska, and like that would end up being horrible. Maybe a little bit of you was like, let's just let the people decide, right? Let's just vote it in. And not foreseeing that that's not how that's going to work.
Right.
But then sticking to your guns, right? Like sticking to that, like, kind of made up idea of, like, you can be pro-union, but you're never really to you never really want to enforce being pro-union, because, like, how else,
right?
Would you...
How does that work?
Right. And, you know, he would die October 8th, 1869, in Concord, New Hampshire. So he would live to see the reunification of the United States and even Reconstruction. But the mark he left would firmly put him as one of the worst presidents. And his only reason he's not lower is because of the person who took the Democratic nomination from him. And next time we talk about another president, we'll be in war. We'll be at war, or damn near close to it.
So the only reason he isn't lower. Well, actually, I think he did out. Did he out? We're going to find out actually how he ranks. Millard Fillmore so far is the lowest on our list, but
hey, what is he? He's in the negatives, right?
Yeah. Millard Fillmore is -9.5.
The half makes that hilarious.
I know, right? All right. Well, let's just dive right into it. What do you say? Get to ranking Mr. Pierce here.
I'm very curious what Kyle thinks about this after listening to
Franklin. Oh, God, this is going to be a tough one here. Political influence, then. Let's just start from the front with our patented POTUS ranking system here. So the president's ability to shape political landscape, including their impact on party dynamics, legislative agendas, and long-term political shifts. It'd be great up until the point he was president.
Yeah, yeah. So I would say he's like a 5.
But then as soon as he becomes the president... Dude, yeah, if you don't get your nominee, like, you are not doing well.
So, like, how many points would you take away for that? Because it's worth a lot to take that away.
Do you think he was more influential or less influential than Millard Fillmore?
Well, he's president?
Yes.
Less. He ripped the party apart more.
Then he has to be -5 or less, because that's what we gave Fillmore.
We gave him -5?
Yeah. That's really amazing. Wanted to hammer
Good
him on
us.
That one.
negative 5.5.
A -5.5 it is.
Yeah.
Okay, president's overall governance then. The effectiveness of his administration in implementing policies, managing the bureaucracy, and maintaining stability in governance.
Our lowest is 7, right? -7?
That's about the low. I think that's the lowest we have gone, but I mean,
let's go -7.
Do whatever
you want. Let's go -7.
-7. Whew, this
oh
is going to be bad.
Yeah, he was. He was. I don't know if you could be worse than him.
Yeah, it's like he tried to do everything backwards.
Right? Like, it was. Right. I can't think of how he could have done anything worse.
Transformational leadership. Capacity to enact significant changes or reforms that alter the course of history. Did they address pressing societal issues and implement lasting change?
Civil War was a pretty big lasting change. How?
Did he address – he kind of exacerbated him when he
tried
to address
him.
He did try to address him, but he just didn't do it well.
Yeah, I'm thinking like a -3.
Yeah. That might even be generous.
Yeah, because I'm trying to like – I don't know. I want to give him credit for the Gadsden Purchase.
I do too, but even that's –
Because, like, the Bloody Kansas is a -7. That's, like, if we say -7 is the lowest you can go, yes, that's, like, you are in the dirt. Like, you are – I want to say the reciprocity tree and the Gadsden Purchase are, like, cool foresights. I think the idea of like
opening Japan, maybe
opening Japan too. Like you think of a large trading power. He's the reason we have anime in the United States. Thank you,
right.
Franklin Pierce for Attack on Titan being in English. Well, it's not in English, but being dubbed. So I think the reciprocity trade in between us and Canada, huge. The Gadsden Purchase is legit. It's like it added a major railroad system that helped develop that entire area of the country.
I didn't even realize that was part of that.
Yeah. I didn't either. That was what I found in research, and I didn't believe it at first. Like what I thought was. I
wondered why we bought that. It's like.
It makes no sense.
Right? Yeah. It's $15 million for this little piece of land, but it's $15 million for the Louisiana territory. It was, $15 million for Alaska?
When I first researched this, a little behind the scenes, I was like, oh, cool. Blah, 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 all that. I was like, oh, I didn't know that the southern route for the Transcontinental Railroad went through where the Gadsden Purchase is. And I was like, wait a minute.
Is that why we paid that purchase?
Was that why we purchased it? And I went and looked up. I was like, no, dude, that's actually why they purchased it. I was like, that's interesting. That's more interesting than I thought it was.
Right? Okay. So
I want to lift it up from the negative seven because of those.
Okay. So negative three seems reasonable then. Understanding public needs. How well did the president understand and respond to the needs and concerns of the public? Did he engage with citizens and address their priorities effectively?
No, he just didn't. I'd give him a zero. I don't, when you talk about the public was so fractured, he just replicated that fraction.
Yeah. He did try to engage. It seemed like he just didn't do it very well.
Yeah. Right.
There's no effectiveness to it whatsoever.
Literally no effectiveness.
Yeah. Strategic vision, clarity and ambition of his vision for the country. Did he have a forward-thinking approach that guided his decisions and inspired hope for the future?
Again, I hate to say this, but it's almost like a zero. He was a shell. He was such a platform-driven person to say he had a vision of the country. Like, he just didn't have anything.
But he did have a platform. I mean, so I feel like he's...
He did, you're right about that. I got a little on the hyperbole side there.
I mean, we gave Millard Fillmore -7. I think he's better than that.
We are angry by the end of that episode. I messed that up because I started the first episode of why you should love Millard Fillmore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I went into oh my God, this guy did so many, he was such a bad president.
It's like we got a two in a row that's they just tried to one up each other.
Yeah, and then we're going to get three in a row with freaking James Buchanan.
Oh, God.
What a piece of... James Buchanan's going to score higher because he did the stuff he outlined that he wanted to do, he did. He just also just didn't give a crap about causing the Civil War. He literally did not care about it. So you get...
That's
gonna
what
be
you
weird.
Get when you hire two compromise candidates in a row.
Yeah, because Lincoln's going to have almost a perfect score based on our category. Our category is almost too well made for Lincoln. Problematically so to our scoring. I don't see any category Lincoln doesn't get a seven in. Not to foreshadow. Maybe as we go, Lincoln's gonna be a long say.
I bet you there's a few things I can ding him for.
Yeah, suspending habeas corpus, stuff like that. That's where he's gonna lose points on the fringe. That's where he's gonna lose, as opposed to these guys who are almost racing to be as bad as humanly possible.
The fringe is where we're looking for to get points to get them off the bottom.
Right. But if we gave Fillmore a -7, we have to give him we have to give Pierce a -7, right? Am I wrong here?
No, I think you can give him a -5 or higher. Or I think he gets a bump up, the Fillmore bump. I think Fillmore was worse.
He really was.
Right?
Dude, he was such a bad president.
Oh my God, I know, poor guy.
let's give him a -5. Yeah, the Fugitive Slave Act that Pierce inherited was from Mill and Fillmore.
But it's just, the clarity, I don't know.
That's vision, right.
His idea of what the vision should have been just seemed wrong to begin with.
May God have mercy on yourself.
-10, -15, -20.5. That's quite impressive. I think that's a new record.
The anti-Mount Rushmore.
God, I know, right? Yeah, he's going right on... to call it Mount Slowless. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for season two. We will likely be doing another Buck Wild interlude so we can see all the things that we missed from Eric's notebook before we move on to season three and that Civil War era. But in the meantime, I want you to tell us all what other major players in this era deserve a spotlight. I will be filibustering for Frederick Douglass to get his own little mini episode.
Yes.
Seeing as how he was the first African American to receive a vote for a presidential nominee.
Yes, and one of Eric's top three favorite Americans.
Actually, he got two votes for a nominee in two separate elections. Did you know that?
That's awesome. I did not
know that. 1848 and in, let's see, where was it? It was 1888 in the Republican National Convention. And he got nominated for vice president in 1872 on the Equal Rights Party ticket.
One of my favorite questions to ask people is that if you were the president and you had to hang, what portrait did you hang up in the White, in the Oval Office?
Frederick Douglass would be a cool one.
Frederick Douglass always makes my list. It would, and it wouldn't be a painting. It would be the photograph of him.
I want Banneker. I want Banneker and Douglass next to each other.
Yeah, I would be. I'd probably do JQA.
Yeah,
John Adams, Eisenhower. So President George Bush actually had a bust of Eisenhower. That looked awesome. But I would
cool.
Eisenhower, the Adamses, Frederick Douglass. Those would be like my four. I'd also controversially George H.W. Bush.
Yeah. I know you like George. It's great.
I love George H.W. Bush. And it's such a wild how much I like that dude. People are like, that's such a weird president to be like, lovely. And then it always makes me get really ranty.
Oh, but it's going to be good because it might be another two more years before we get to that point. But
it's going to be hard. That's going to be a hard episode to do.
We will get to that one.
We will get there. Oh, if anything drives us to finish it, it's to do the George.
To get George, yes.
It's going to be me smoking a cigarette, being like, okay, let's go.
With all the bubbles and behind you. All right. Yeah, if there's anybody else that you guys want us to cover before we move on to season three, please drop those in the comments. Send us an email at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. Do not forget to play Thumbs Up 7 Up on your way out, and we will see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.